Occult Confessions is brought to you commercial free through the generous support of our patrons. Visit occultconfessions.com and click on donate to help keep the history of the occult on the digital airwaves. This is part two of two parts about Annie Besant in our series on Jiddu Krishnamurti. Annie Besant's secular political crusade underwent a tremendous shift when she read Helena Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine and quickly rose to become the head of theosophy the worldwide following Blavatsky's death. Peter Washington, in his gossipy but well-researched account of the early theosophists, accused Besant of a predilection for moving from cause to cause inspired by father-like figures she sought out to fill the gap left by her own father's early passing. Washington's account is problematic because of the way it deprives Besant of agency, and his characterization of her belies some fundamentals within Besant's life. First, there were steady through lines throughout her career. She was always highly interested in matters of the spirit, and her very religious girlhood suggests that she could have never rested wholly content with secular materialism. Political radicalism was another constant feature of her character, persisting and morphing over time from birth control to socialism to her quest for Indian nationalism, but her fight for the political underdog was very consistent in its various forms. Also, when she arrived at theosophy, she more or less quit seeking and spent the better part of her adult life in service to the society, which really wasn't a father issue so much as a mother issue. Helena Blavatsky, after all, was a woman. In theosophy, she no longer jumped from cause to cause, but stayed put. Insofar as she had held leadership roles in secularism and workers' rights movements as well, her presidency could hardly have been what kept her in place. Theosophy gave her what she had been looking for, and that's the story we've got to tell today. But first, an atheist is thrown bodily out of the halls of Parliament. My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson. I am your Supreme Hierophant for today's proceedings. We've got a quieter part two here. Brie Litterall's on the other side of the table with me.
Hi, everybody.
And that's it. Just the two of us. For those of you who don't like all the chatter, it'll just be Brie today.
Yeah, I'm pretty relaxed about these sorts of things.
It'll be a more relaxed chatter situation. All right. What do you mean you're relaxed?
I have things to say, and I get excited, but at least I'd say those things and express my excitement more coherently for the audience.
That's true, yeah, that's true. Some people struggle to stay on topic.
A little precise.
I hear that, all right. Let's pledge it out.
We, the members of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors, do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it.
All right, let's bring Annie Besant's story up as far as we're going to go today, which is the discovery of Krishnamurti. So we're not going to tell Besant's whole life. Her death and all those sorts of events will happen during our Krishnamurti episodes, but I want to get her story told all the way up to the time that she meets Krishnamurti. So that's today's work. And it's a big one today because this is her conversion to theosophy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And also her introduction to India. Annie Besant was embroiled in a brand new controversy when her co-editor, Bradlaugh, was re-elected to Parliament and, as an atheist, refused to take the standard oath on the Bible.
Ah.
Yeah.
I see. That would be problematic.
That is not going to go over well. He preferred to take an affirmation, okay, which he had done in court. Remember, they had been tried for
obscenity,
essentially, and believed that he should stand in the halls of Parliament with an affirmation just the same. So, no Bible in court. Why do we need one in the halls of Parliament? What's the difference here?
I get that.
But this became a fairly epic struggle for him to accomplish. So he's got like an Annie Besant vibe. The two of them like got along for good reasons. He refuses. Like the easy thing would be to just, you know,
comply,
hold your nose.
Yeah.
But no, he's trying to make a point here. He was briefly imprisoned in the clock tower.
How of the times.
Yes. I mean, it's like the 1890s, so yeah, it's not like it's,
that's
you
true.
Know, Richard III or anything.
Why
but,
the
yeah.
clock tower? Do they not have somewhere more suited for imprisonment? I don't.
So he can keep track of how long he's been in there.
Okay. Hear the chimes the loudest.
Yes. That's 15 minutes. So he was briefly imprisoned there before being allowed to do his affirmation. But then he was sued by the Tories over and over again for refusing to take the standard oath.
So they imprisoned him in the clock tower mm-hmm. because he wanted to do an affirmation, but then proceeded to allow the affirmation to take place?
Yeah, I don't know if it was an imprisonment so much as like a sit over there while we talk about this.
Okay, yeah. That makes more sense.
But still, it feels imprisoning.
Yeah, they allowed it to take place, though. And then they said, oh, we let that happen. We should sue him for it.
Yes. Well, the Tories, okay. I guess, let it pass. But then, they thought back on it. They were like, wait, we could make political hay out of this. We can have a whole big political mess for this guy.
I guess if you
guy.
Don't sue him, you don't get any sort of potential settlement for it or anything like that.
The goal, I guess, would be to replace him with a Tory or something. Yeah. Anyhow, he was removed from Parliament again, and he returned again.
Okay.
And one of my favorite stories, he was sort of back and forth. And at one point, he was physically thrown out into the palace yard, which injured him. He was a large guy, but he was not young anymore. Mm. Like, he was in his late 60s, I think. Bradlaugh's defenders, many independent-minded working men from Northampton. Let's remember, this guy is getting elected by the Northampton working class for the most part.
Okay.
These guys love him.
Yeah.
They had come to support him that day. I don't know that the Northampton guys are like, go atheism, but they're like, we elected this guy.
Yeah.
And he let him do what he has to do. He needs to represent us. So they all gathered up there to, cause a stir. And, Bradlaugh, he said to them, go.
Leave.
And I will meet you away from this area.
I respect that, though.
After he had been thrown out on his butt, right? He could have started a riot right then and there if he wanted to. A lesson in American politics here.
That says a
British
lot about
politics.
His person that he said, let me be an adult about this.
We have had politicians who've been happy to start riots. Bradlaugh says no. Go, Bradlaugh, go.
Yep.
What are we talking about? So he says, go ahead, go away. And he did go and address them and, connect with them. In all events, he eventually took the oath with the Bible and was allowed to join Parliament in 1886. Each time Parliament rejected him and forced his district to revote, he was elected again. He had been elected by Northampton five times before he was finally allowed to just take the oath. And he did it so that he could change the law.
Right.
Basically, there was no other way. He had to take the oath and then change the law so he never had to do it again.
Right.
And that's what he did. In 1888, he passed a bill allowing affirmation in place of an oath for MPs. But five times.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Every single time his constituents said, you're not replacing him. This is the guy we want. We asked for this guy. Yeah. Stop sending him back. It's pretty awesome. Go, Northampton.
It's pretty good, yeah.
If you're out there listening from Northampton, you got to be proud of your ancestors there. In 1878, Besant became interested in British policy in India and advocated for a liberty-loving approach. So this is interesting because she's not a theosophist yet. And theosophists are famously obsessed with India.
Right.
And yet, she's looking at the India problem, mm-hmm. the British in India, and she's saying, this is not right. There's some unfairness here. Something needs to be done. She also incidentally wrote out against the invasion of Afghanistan.
Oh.
Yeah. which invasion of Afghanistan?
Right.
But, of course, back when the British were up to it.
Yeah.
But, of course, she was right there. Nobody invades Afghanistan, and it's a good idea.
Yeah.
She briefly defended the practice of vivisection. I think this is interesting.
Okay, that's really cool.
So, vivisection is the live dissection of animals, uh-huh. right? So Besant said, yeah, I see value in this because, I'm sure there was medical reasons. I didn't actually read her defense of this, but I'm interested in this because she believed, Besant, that vivisection was done rarely and that it was done with care. But then she received a letter from Dr. Anna Kingsford, one of my favorite occultists, who convinced her otherwise. Kingsford crusaded against vivisection,
right.
Famously going all the way to Pasteur's lab to tell mm-hmm. him this must end. And Besant published Kingsford in the National Review.
I want to clarify that my "that's cool" wasn't because I'm 4/5 section.
Oh.
It was because I feel like it doesn't seem like something that she would be interested about.
Yeah, interested in. So she originally said, yeah, vivisection is fine. I think it's rare. You should do it. Kingsford writes to her and says, on second thought. And Besant's like, you know what? I never thought about it that way. I'm going to publish you in The Reformer.
I respect that.
And she changed her mind. Yeah, After she read Kingsford, she changed her mind, regretting afterward having ever defended vivisection. I note this because I'm a great fan of Kingsford, and for the fact that Kingsford became the London president of the Theosophical Society and was then ejected over doctrinal differences more than 8 years before Besant would join and eventually become international president of the Theosophists. It's a very strange coincidence that they ever had an exchange.
Yeah.
They're also both like famous Annies of Theosophical import, the two Annies. Washington tries to draw more connections between them, but it's all coincidental.
Mm.
Besant was drawn to socialism via George Bernard Shaw. Now, if you're not a theater nerd, George Bernard Shaw was one of the great playwrights of the turn of the century. Wrote very long and difficult plays about political issues. even if you're not a fan of theater, he also incidentally defined realism essentially through his reading of Henri Gibson. So when we think about realism today, we owe a lot to George Bernard Shaw. But if you're into politics, you may know the name Shaw because he was a Fabian socialist.
Mm.
And he wrote against a bill stipulating a maximum 12-hour workday. Oh, I'm sorry. Besant did that, inspired by Shaw.
Okay.
So 12-hour workday. Let's think about that for a second. I do that occasionally.
I'd rather not.
Have you done that? Have you done a 12-hour workday?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, it's not fun.
I mean, I do theater. It's fun. I teach.
Yeah,
but still,
yeah.
12 hours is a lot.
It's a lot.
And if we're thinking about like a real hard labor, guys in the factories and the mines and what have you, a 12-hour workday, come on now.
Yeah, no.
So Besant suggested an 8-hour day, 5 days a week.
Ah.
Weird, right?
That's so strange.
How
okay.
strange. She also said no more than 5 hours on the sixth day. My dad used to work Saturdays in the mornings, so.
I had to think about that for a second. I was like, the sixth day.
Yeah, my dad was a machinist, so basically the same kind of, he would repair the machines that worked in the factories. And Saturday mornings would be like, if he wanted overtime,
right?
He would work Saturday mornings. Her embrace of socialism marked a break with Bradlaugh, who remained her close friend, but no longer consulted her on government policy as he had done from the first. That is to say, Besant was deeply sincere about this turn toward socialism, which was consistent with her steady concern for the lives of the working classes. It's not that Bradlaugh was against... he just wasn't on board with the whole socialist platform. It is true that he was not. Yeah, it just wasn't his thing. Besant said, "We cover our heartlessness and indifference with fine phrases about sapping the independence of the poor and destroying their self-respect. With loathsome hypocrisy, we repair a prince's palace for him and let him live in it rent-free, without one word about the degradation involved in his thus living upon charity while we refuse to pauperize the toiler by erecting decent buildings in which he may live."
Damn.
Yeah. She joined the Fabian Society and lectured and wrote for them. She also formed a group to support suffering Russians. There you go, Brie.
Yeah. Is that your call out to
Those
me?
Those are your people.
They're my people.
Yeah. Apparently, and I did not know this, I actually don't know the history or politics of this, but London apparently had a population of suffering Russians. Well, let's think of
that
this.
That doesn't surprise me, though. What is the time frame
for
this?
It's the 1890s, right? So
yeah, so that's not too far
Russia
before.
Russia itself.
Yeah.
What? Go ahead.
So like 1910 is when the...
That's World War I.
Yeah, but that's also around when they first had like... I'm remembering this correctly. It's been a minute since I've looked at the original Russian constitution. But this is when they... were trying to re-advocate for fixing that. This was before like things got really, really haywire.
Yeah.
And before like, this is like right before the first of the more modern revolutions for Russia, I believe.
Yeah. 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 The 1890s weren't even in Nicholas the II.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they were suffering.
They were.
So she participated in the formation of the Matchmakers Union and joined the London School Board. Let's go back to the Matchmakers Union.
Yeah, what is that?
So I know it sounds like these are people like cooking people up.
I don't think it is, though.
It's literal makers of matches. It's mostly women who made matches.
Ah, like matches. I was like, makers of matches. That still sounds like the same thing. No, okay.
Yes. Not match.com.
That's interesting.
It's as if Match.com sent you books of matches.
I wish they did. What's the point of being called Match.com if you're not going to send saucy matchboxes?
Yeah, when you do get married, I think that Match.com should send you a complimentary box of massive matches. Come on.
What are you doing?
Her commitment to socialism caused her to give up co-editorship of the National Reformer after her long tenure of 13 years, since Bradlaugh tended to disagree with socialist principles, and she told her readers that a political paper should have a single practical political perspective.
It's fair.
Yeah. She's like that correspondent on Fox News who's not on board with, you know,
right,
MAGA.
Yeah.
Yeah. That MSNBC conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. Go do something else. Those people don't usually last long, I think.
No, no, not at all. Not
those
at
journalists,
all.
They're like in and out. They last for like 6 months and they can't take it anymore. She gradually withdrew from Bradlaugh's public and political life, feeling that her radicalism hampered him now that he was no longer an outcast. So when he wasn't an MP, when, you know, he had, you know, published the birth control pamphlet and everyone was upset at him, she was like, okay, we're close buddies. But then when he got back into power, she said, you know, I'm still kind of nuts in relation to you. So I'm going to keep doing my radical thing and we're going to create some distance here.
Yeah.
Very mature. But Bradlaugh's high opinion of her intellect persisted. That is, until she joined the Theosophical Society and, I'm quoting her here, he lost his trust in my reasoning powers and judgment.
You know, I can't shame him for
He's
that.
He's an atheist, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Besant first wrote about the Theosophists. Now here it's time, right? Time to do this. Conversion.
Oh, okay.
She first wrote about them in answer to a question about whether they might overlap with the secularists. So somebody said, dear Annie, dear Abby, dear Annie, do you think atheism and the Theosophists have anything in common? Besant believed at that time that their supernaturalism didn't fit with the scientific materialism of the secular society. But Madame Blavatsky wrote a reply in her own newspaper, The Theosophist, to Besant, informing Besant that she was misled about the true nature of theosophy. So Blavatsky is always trying to, you know, win converts.
She's always
here.
Always working.
All those wheels are always turning. She's a very smart woman. Whatever you want to say about her, and people say a lot of things about her, she's a very clever woman.
Mm-hmm.
She reads this in, you know, the atheist press, and she says, no. You guys have a place in my tent. Come on over. Still, Besant said, at this time, she was too proud and ignorant to give herself over to the school of occultism and study the science of the soul. This is Besant's own, you know, looking back. Then in 1889, she met and became the pupil of Helena Blavatsky. Her conversion was driven in part by her feeling that her socialism lacked a spiritual component. Much indeed had been done, but there was not a real movement of self-sacrificing devotion in which men worked for love's sake only and asked but to give, not to take. Much indeed had been done, but there was not a real movement of self-sacrificing devotion in which men worked for love's sake only and asked but to give, not to take.
Mm.
You see?
Yeah.
It's a little too materialist for her. Advances in psychology, particularly the unlooked-for complexities discovered through hypnosis, complicated her materialism, and she studied the obscurer sides of consciousness, including dreams, hallucinations, illusions, insanity, and, perhaps most significantly, she read A.P. Sinnott's Occult World, where he detailed his adventures with Blavatsky.
Oh, okay.
She began to experiment with spiritualism. So, remember, there was all these mediums still running around. They've been running around since 1848. But found the spiritualistic explanation for the phenomena she experienced incredible, but genuine. So, I guess by incredible, she means hard to believe, but real. Her editor at the magazine she was writing for at the time, The Review of Reviews, which is a great name. I like to think of this as the podcast of podcasts.
Yeah, it's delightful.
He handed her a copy of The Secret Doctrine, asking if she could write about Blavatsky's tome. The editor, as it happens, was W.T. Stead. W.T. Stead was a noted Fabian socialist. He would become, in his lifetime, an ardent spiritualist as we move through the turn of the century, and then a decade later, he would go down on the Titanic in 1912.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating?
That is a wild ride that man took.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. But he was publishing Besant back in 1889-ish. As she read it, Besant said, so she's reading The Secret Doctrine. So Stead hands Besant, I mean, yeah, really, think about this guy. He goes down on the Titanic, and he's the one who introduces Besant to theosophy, the woman who comes to define theosophy in the 20th century. As she read it, Besant said, I'm quoting her, I was dazzled, blinded by the light, in which disjointed facts were seen as parts of a mighty whole, and all my puzzles, riddles, problems seemed to disappear. After writing her review, she asked her editor for an introduction to the author and went with Herbert Burroughs to 17 Lansdowne Road, the home of The Secret Doctrine's editors, Bertram and Archibald Keightley, where she came face to face with Blavatsky for the first time. That was easy.
Yeah, that was shockingly easy.
I mean, she's a famous lady, though. Andy Besant's a big deal. So if she wants to come to your house, you make time. Blavatsky's book had received mixed reviews, with many misunderstanding her project, and she was all too happy to let Besant in. I say this often about occult books. Now, today, let me just pause about Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. I know you've all heard my opinions about Secret Doctrine. We have to note, right, there are Atlanteans and Lemurians and ancient
yes,
races
there are.
Of people, right?
There are
interplanetary angels. This is a lot, a whole lot to take in. My people today, speaking of like occultism scholars, people who do what I do for a living and in scholarship, which, you know, we don't really get paid as scholars, but, you know, anyway, it's technically our job. But my people honor Blavatsky generally, and we like her, or we consider her to be a significant figure because of the way she blended Western occultism and Eastern occultism in a truly creative and like sort of amazing way. But it's easy to not see that, right, at the day that the book is published, when there's all these Atlanteans and Lemurians running around, and interplanetary angels, and
there's a lot that's in your face that almost it obscures the point that exists there within.
Seeing the depth requires seeing past some strange,
and it's quite. The strangeness to get past, especially at the time.
Yes. I mean, when I did Secret Doctrine for this show, I talked about the metaphors that I was reading into it.
Right.
There's so much that can be done, but anyway, if she just pushes this out today, you know, people would be saying, what are you talking about? I don't know, maybe not. We're in a different time. She'd end up the leader of a conspiracy theory movement.
She'd probably actually have a cult.
Yeah, she'd have a TikTok channel. She'd be on. No, she wouldn't have TikTok. Not Blavatsky.
No. She wouldn't dare.
Not Blavatsky. YouTube. She would have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Of this first encounter with Blavatsky, Annie Besant said, she talked of travels of various countries. Easy, brilliant talk, her eyes veiled, her exquisitely molded fingers rolling cigarettes incessantly. Never heard about her fingers before.
No, but I liked that visual you just gave me.
Yeah, just rolling and rolling. That would be kind of soothing if she was, you know. Nothing special to record, no word of occultism, nothing mysterious. A woman of the world chatting with her evening visitors. We rose to go, and for a moment the veil lifted. Okay. And two brilliant, piercing eyes met mine. And with a yearning throb in the voice, she said, oh, my dear Mrs. Besant, if you would only come among us. I felt a well-nigh uncontrollable desire to bend down and kiss her under the compulsion of that yearning voice, those compelling eyes. But with a flash of the old unbending pride and an inward jeer at my own folly, I said a commonplace polite goodbye and turned away with some inanely courteous and evasive remark. Child, she said to me long afterwards, your pride is terrible. You are as proud as Lucifer himself.
I would have kissed her.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's... She compared her pride to Lucifer.
Well, I mean, from Blavatsky, that's not such a bad thing.
No, I know. But, like, to her.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting episode. I think it's an interesting... I love these, like, glimmers of Blavatsky from other people. She's such a clever politician in a way. She's not talking about the weird.
Yep.
She's got the weird in the background. She saves that just for her inner circle.
Yeah.
And what she's saying to Besant there is... If you want the weird, you want the weird.
Yeah,
I can tell you want
the weird.
The weird.
Yeah.
You have got to join the inner circle. So Besant returned to Lansdowne Road, of course, where Blavatsky fixed her with a piercing gaze and asked, have you read the report about me in the Society for Psychical Research? Bassan had never heard of it, and so Blavatsky told her to go and read it, and if, after reading it, she decided that she wanted to come back, then theosophy might actually be for her.
Right.
Then Blavatsky changed the subject back to her travels.
She's so clever. She drops it and then pulls it back just so she's always within rain.
Yes, I gotta say again, people pick on me because I like Blavatsky. Oh, Blavatsky was a fraud and this, that, and the other. Fine, whatever. Yeah. Maybe that's true, but she was also this.
Yes.
Okay. Blavatsky had been referring in this instant, and I think this is fascinating as well, to the infamous Hodgson report, which, on the advice of a disgruntled servant, accused Blavatsky of fraudulently producing the letters from her ascended masters using a trick cabinet at the Society's headquarters in India. We did a whole thing on this years ago. My season 5, I think, is about Blavatsky, and I did a whole episode about the Hodgson report.
Yeah.
I think it's called Blavatsky versus the SPR, something like this.
Yeah.
And the accusations are bizarre. The things she achieved occult-wise, or the tricks, whatever you want to call them, were bizarre.
Yes.
Everything about it was just fantastically strange. Tea sets buried in on hills. You remember this?
Yes, I do. It was very...
Jewels in pillows.
I remember listening to you as we were sitting there, and I was like, This is insane.
It's weird.
Like, this is insanity.
And the Hodgson report created a narrative for how she might be falsely producing the letters, and there's a lot of arguments about Blavatsky potentially faking her letters. However, this other stuff, it just didn't explain some of these things.
Right.
She had a confederate, somebody was helping her, but even that didn't explain all of it. I mean, she's like a tremendous magician, illusionist, even if the magic didn't actually accomplish these things. But what's also interesting about this is she's saying to Bassan, read it.
Yeah.
Decide whether I'm a fraud or not. And if you think I'm a fraud, don't bother with it. Carry on. She's not hiding her dirty laundry here.
Which is very, very smart.
Right. She's right out in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very modern tactic, really. Bassan couldn't believe what she read. She said, "Was the writer of The Secret Doctrine this miserable imposter? I laughed aloud at the absurdity." It's basically my own conclusion. When I concluded that series on Blavatsky, and maybe you guys don't need to go back and listen because I'm basically quickly rehashing it, but we did hours and hours of this. But I said The Secret Doctrine is an amazing book. Mm. The rest of it is what it is. I can't say at all this time in the future what she did in India. Bassan couldn't say from London what she did over in India. But it's an amazing book. So Bassan is saying, okay, she wrote this amazing book. Why would she also be like a cheap parlor magician on the side?
Right.
It just seems odd. Returning, Blavatsky said to Bassan, "You have joined the society. You have read the report." "Well..." Bassan knelt down before Blavatsky, clasped her hand in hers, looked straight into her eyes, and said, "Will you accept me as your pupil and give me the honor of proclaiming you my teacher in the face of the world?" Blavatsky's eyes welled with tears, and she placed her hand on Bassan's head, saying, "You are a noble woman. May Master bless you." The date was the 10th of May, 1889. Blavatsky would only live another 2 years afterward. She knew. This was the future.
Yep.
She saw in Bassan all these things. Bassan said, "I have been told that I plunged headlong into theosophy and let my enthusiasm carry me away. I think the charge is true, insofar as the decision was swiftly taken, but it had been long led up to, and realized the dreams of childhood on the higher planes of intellectual womanhood. I know by personal experiment that the soul exists, and that my soul, not my body, is myself. That it can leave the body at will, that it can, disembodied, reach and learn from living human teachers and bring back and impress on the physical brain that which it has learned."
I love it.
it makes sense for her personality.
Yeah.
This is not like she was Svengalied. She wasn't culted into this.
No,
right?
Like this is from her. This is her belief.
Mm-hmm. It's all Bassan.
Yep.
For his part, the atheist member of parliament, Bradlaugh, was pretty well beside himself over the whole thing.
Oh, I can imagine. I forgot about him for 2 seconds.
Like
I was so wrapped
buddy.
Up in this.
Yeah. Writing in response to her glowing review of The Secret Doctrine, he said, I feel very deeply regret indeed that my colleague and co-worker has, with somewhat of suddenness and without any interchange of ideas with myself, adopted as facts manners which seem to me to be as unreal as it is possible for any fiction to be. My regret is greater, as I know Mrs. Besant's devotion to any course she believes to be true. I know that she will always be earnest in the advocacy of any views she undertakes to defend, and I look to possible developments of her theosophic views with the very gravest misgivings.
That's so sad. That's such like a sad falling apart of two people that were at some point on such a wavelength together.
I like to think that a friendship persisted, but yes, something had very deeply changed there. And he, even in saying that she's misguided here, is, you know, giving her the compliment of, what makes me saddest about this is that you are a remarkable public speaker and you will definitely win people over to this organization, which I think is full of nonsense. George Bernard Shaw, Besant's socialist, older male mentor, was less caustic and went on to base a character on her in his play Arms and the Man. Shaw even went so far as to claim falsely that he had first sent Besant the copy of The Secret Doctrine that led to her conversion. So
everybody's got angles.
Not a theosophist, but I do think Shaw, like that, the soul of the artist in Shaw, like Bradlaugh's a politician, Shaw's an artist, and of course Shaw's going to be more amenable to eccentric views.
Right.
With Blavatsky's elaborate history of evolution from the time of Atlantis and Lemuria, hermetic plan for the soul in line with the alchemical emerald tablet, and pantheon of otherworldly beings from elementals to planetary angels, it is understandable that Besant's atheist pals would have a hard time digesting her newfound enthusiasm for theosophy. But looking at the trajectory of her life, Besant was a religious person from childhood, deeply invested in a spiritual search. Big science was no replacement for God, and her various social causes, while admirable, sought to alleviate the material conditions of suffering without suggesting a meaning or purpose for that suffering or for the existence of these people broadly conceived. Think about it. Like, your whole life is about saving people's lives and making their lives better and helping the poor. But you don't have any concept for why it's like this.
Yeah.
There's no deeper meaning to any of it. And they're dying.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she's, of course, accomplishing things, and socialism is accomplishing things, and her political causes are accomplishing things, but people are still dying horribly of disease and famine and all sorts of stuff. And it just, it must seem fairly meaningless when you're on this atheist track. What do you do with all this?
Very bleak.
Yeah. Besant is in the trenches. She's not living a charmed life.
Mm-mm.
She's down there with people, the Match Girls. Right? The
Match Girls.
Remember the Match Girls.
Yeah.
Secularism and socialism left the soul adrift, and Besant with an existential malaise that she sought to satisfy by undertaking an experimental inner journey. Having arrived at her politics, Besant still hadn't found her religion, and Blavatsky, at least in theory, offered a fairly open-ended means to explore the question with a promise of a higher meaning and purpose, albeit a fairly novel one involving reincarnation and the steady progress of the soul over millennia. If the transition seems extreme, we have to remember that Besant was either all in or all out on any proposition, as Bradlaugh suggested. Theosophy's promise to merge science with spirit, recover the lost wisdom of the ages, and answer the mysteries of mediumship and consciousness were, I think, too much for Besant to pass up. These were all the things she thought were cool at that moment. She wrote a pamphlet based on two lectures she gave at the Hall of Science explaining her conversion. So she goes to the Hall of Science.
I love it.
To tell them, I'm a theosophist and you can too. Dear science, she argued that atheist perspective that humans and animals were the only sentient beings in the cosmos was hard to reconcile with humans' understanding of the vastness of the universe, and that theosophy helped to resolve this question, presumably with its pantheon of otherworldly beings, but also with its openness to evolving beings across time and space. Further, and perhaps more damningly, she said, refusal to believe until proof is given is a rational position. Denial of all outside our own limited experience is absurd. Stop being so arrogant.
Yeah.
Hall of Science.
I get that.
Right?
Yeah. It's not wrong.
Yep. It's a reasonable attitude.
Mm-hmm.
In 1890, she worked with Blavatsky to open a home for working girls. How about that?
That's pretty cool.
And I do believe we don't mean prostitutes there. We mean girls who work.
Actual work. Well, I mean prostitutes work
working
too.
Girls too,
but,
yeah.
But outside of prostitution,
laboring
working
girls.
Laboring girls.
Yeah. And not in pregnancy. So
no.
The Theosophists also created the Blavatsky Lodge, where Besant, odd that they didn't have one until then. Besant rose to the office of president of the Blavatsky Lodge and spent much of her time being tutored by Blavatsky. Other Theosophists became jealous of their close relationship, and Blavatsky named her co-editor of the Theosophical newspaper, Lucifer. Imagine that. Hmm. I'm going to quote Besant here. The rules of the house were and are very simple, but HPB insisted on great regularity of life. We breakfasted at 8 a.m., worked till lunch at 1, then again till dinner at 7. After dinner, the outer work of the society was put aside, and we gathered in HPB's room, where we would sit talking over plans, receiving instructions, listening to her explanations of naughty points. By 12 midnight, all the lights had to be extinguished, so we can start all over, I presume.
It's like a day camp.
Yeah, it is for
it's very scheduled.
Adults who talk about Atlantis.
Yes.
In 1891, Besant found herself largely leaderless. With the death of both Blavatsky and Bradlaugh. They died the same year.
Oh, wow.
She was away lecturing in America when Blavatsky died, and Blavatsky bequeathed her the presidency of the esoteric section, the only official organ of the society that Blavatsky ran directly. Remember, Olcott had been the political head of Theosophy for its entire existence, so Blavatsky only ran this quarter that was focused on occultism, essentially. I mean, the whole thing was interested in occultism, but there's this little group of people.
It's a little spicy.
Yeah. They were important. They were an important political group within the society, but Olcott was the head. In a struggle for leadership within the society, Besant sided initially with William Quan Judge, the head of the American section, against Henry Olcott, Blavatsky's longtime confederate, and as I said, the original president of the society. So Blavatsky dies, and Judge makes a move to take over the whole operation. The old guard is gone. It's time to start new. Judge claimed that the masters, the ascended masters of the White Lodge, wanted Olcott out. But Olcott responded that Judge had never been able to communicate directly with the masters before Blavatsky's death and accused him of now faking their communications.
Yeah, he really didn't think about that rebuttal.
Should have, yeah.
Yeah. Feels like the obvious thing to happen if you were to say that.
Open that line of communication before the old lady passes.
Yeah.
After traveling to India, Besant decided Olcott was in the right, and the society determined that Olcott should stay as its head, concluding along the way that belief or disbelief in the master's messages was up to the individual. This was an important asterisk.
Yeah.
So Besant breaks the tie between them and sides with Olcott, but the asterisk is, from now on, let's not take the masters too seriously. Because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little problematic sometimes.
Besant and Judge had a falling out and expelled each other from Blavatsky's esoteric section, which by then they were running jointly.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I was like, they expelled each other, and then you finished that sentence, and I was like, it got dumber. Okay.
Yes.
They're both joint running it, and they said, I expel you.
Yes.
And then they said it back.
Yeah,
so
and it doesn't
exist. We're just both there still.
You're both in and out at the same time. The question of the master's letters continuing to appear after Blavatsky's death is of interest to me. So I want to take a moment for this. It's not a small question, and it's the kind of mystery we like best here at Occult Confessions. So let's dig in for a sec. It's quite a scandal, actually. So on her return to England following Blavatsky's death, Annie Besant first announced to an audience of freethinkers, also known as secularists, at the Hall of Science, that she was receiving letters from the Mahatmas. Boy, she had no shame.
There is no shame. No. Oh, my.
It's Mahatma time.
It's Mahatma time.
Secularists.
Listen up.
It's time for you to learn about the Great Lodge of Ascended Masters. They asked, but she would not elaborate, how their precipitated communications came to her. But she said they had the same handwriting as earlier letters. So Besant, after Blavatsky's death, suddenly is in the habit of receiving these letters. I'm sure she was getting them from Blavatsky as well, but now Blavatsky's gone and the letters are coming.
Right.
A subsequent expose by Edmund Garrett titled Isis Very Much Unveiled, cute, showed that the letters had only appeared in the presence of Judge, the American president, and her rival. Olcott's rival ultimately becomes her rival, who had brought with him to England from America a letter from a master and from the deceased Blavatsky. So he's got two letters, one from deceased Blavatsky, one from a master.
Okay.
In fact, Judge got into the habit of writing letters to various society luminaries and co-signing them alongside the Master Moria. So he would just write out all his thoughts to you. Do this, do this, do this. Mm-hmm. I highly advise that you do this. And he'd sign it, and then Master Moria would just...
stamp it.
Stamp it. Yeah, gotcha. Me too. Okay. I think that too. I'm Master Moria. I approve this message. Bassant was willing to go along with Judge's precipitated letters. Henry Olcott, on the other hand, he's been around the block. Mm-hmm. Olcott also, I have to say, often accused of being like a fool, right? Just like being fooled by Blavatsky and being completely under her spell. He was not...
I don't think that's the case.
Not a stupid man.
I don't think she would put herself in the presence of somebody who was so easy to manipulate. Yeah. Like, she's not a... Yes, she's very smart, she's very clever, but I don't think she would want to be around somebody who isn't to that level, in that degree, if that makes sense.
I mean, his utility would be lower. Right. I think he was certainly enamored of her. Mm-hmm. I don't mean romantically.
Who wasn't?
Yeah, enamored of her presence. Yeah, she was a remarkable person in that way, very charismatic, but Olcott was also very critical.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he had blind spots, but... Anyway, in this case with Judge, she's not buying anything.
Yeah.
The story of how Olcott caught Judge faking is a bit convoluted, so follow me here, Bree.
Okay.
In 1883, Olcott had a seal resembling the seal of Master Moria made for Blavatsky.
Okay.
Which is eccentric and weird.
Uh-huh.
Olcott considered it kind of a joke to be sent on to Moria himself. So I think what he did is, he was in India, and he had somebody replicate the Master Moria's seal as a souvenir.
Okay.
And for some reason wanted to send it on to Master Moria. I don't get it.
That's weird.
He showed it to Blavatsky, and she said, oh, it's not quite right. The seal that you made was not rendered quite right. There's this mistake and this mistake. You know, if you look at the seal over here, it doesn't quite look like what you made, Henry. So the actual master's seal had slight differences, and she then kept this seal among her effects.
Uh-huh.
And Keightley observed her with it in 1888 at Lansdowne Road. All very strange, but... don't think this is a sign of Blavatsky faking letters. And I'm not convinced that she didn't fake letters, but in this instance, this seal that Olcott produced, Blavatsky herself said, it's not quite right.
Right. Like, she wouldn't call it out if she was trying to fool anybody with it.
Why Olcott made it, why she was keeping it. Like, they're all weird people. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
They're a little strange, but anyway, the thing's kicking around this drawer of hers, her junk mm-hmm. drawer. When he asked about it, she said it was only one of Olcott's flapdoodles. Mm-hmm. Keightley, that is. One of her editors, Keightley. One of the editors of Secret Doctrine. One of his flapdoodles. The flapdoodle apparently disappeared after Judge visited with Blavatsky. Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
And its mark surfaced on a letter of his endorsing something he had written in the script of Master Moria.
Right.
So Master Moria writes a letter, seals it, and Olcott says, about that seal.
It ain't right.
There's a couple of things wrong with that, and I know because Blavatsky told me. Blavatsky had never used the mark, but here apparently Judge had in an attempt to impersonate a master.
Mm.
Then, when Judge attempted to use the seal on a message to Olcott, too close to the sun, he got caught. Olcott was like, I know that seal.
Yeah.
I know its errors. When Judge tried to justify himself, claiming that the master psychically oversaw Olcott's purchase of the seal, he only made it worse by naming the wrong city where the seal was made.
Oh my God.
Moria was there with you in wherever. Calcutta. I was in Benares. With Olcott suspicious, Judge sought to separate Bassant from him and sent her a telegram warning her not to go to India because of grave danger. Both Judge and the Master followed up with letters explaining that Olcott may try to poison her.
All right.
Something he had never done to anyone before. Judge got himself elected to succeed Olcott as president, but a judicial proceeding within the society found him guilty of defrauding the membership, and so Olcott and Bassant bargained with him to keep the findings under wraps in exchange for his stepping down in favor of Olcott returning to his post. not ideal in any way. He's committing this fraud. The society decides to keep it under wraps, but kicks him out of the power position. Right. Not the most honest of maneuvers, and yet it all, I guess, works out in the end for Olcott. Bassan's trip to India, however, was monumental. She had been greeted like royalty by Olcott and a crew of Buddhist and Indian officials and went on to tour the country, performing for audiences as large as 6,000. Yeah.
Okay.
Instant celebrity.
Yeah.
Her radical politics translated easily to India, where she advocated for Indian nationalism, and the press began to portray her as a kind of mother goddess figure, which I'm sure she loved, and call on her to aid them in overthrowing colonial rule. She's Blavatsky 2.0.
Yeah.
But, you know, younger and public speaking, right? Mm-hmm. More so. Much Blavatsky didn't get up to that too much.
Mm-mm.
Bassan's stance was not necessarily that the British Raj should end, but rather that India should be granted dominion status, entailing the right to self-governance. So she's not saying the British have to leave, but she is saying they need to let India rule itself. A kind of nuanced position. Olcott worried over the way Bassan's politics privileged Hindus, preferring to view Theosophy as a neutral party in both politics and religion. Olcott, after all, is considered to be the white Buddhist. He was a huge proponent of Buddhism all over the world. Got his picture on a postage stamp in Sri Lanka.
Oh. That's impressive.
I think Bassan is on an Indian postage stamp, by the way. In 1893, Bassant represented the Theosophists at the World's Parliament of Religions, the same event where Swami Vivekananda inspired Western interest in Indian philosophy. By 1896, she had established herself at Benares, not the Society's international headquarters, which, as you all know, is located in Adyar. But she would meet in Benares, where she spent her winters. The Indian section of the Society was run out of Benares. So, international headquarters are in Adyar, India. But India's actual operation is run out of Benares. That's where she prefers to go. Bassant helped to establish a Hindu college there that more or less followed her political program. Then, in 1894, she met Charles Leadbetter, another prominent Theosophist, and they began a lifelong collaboration. Both were ascendant within the society at the time of their meeting. Leadbetter would go on to become a noted lecturer and write prolifically. He was, like Bassant's estranged husband, an Anglican clergyman. Think about that. I mean, we know that about Leadbetter, but isn't that funny?
Can't get away from him.
No, these guys keep chasing me down. He was also the first clergyman to become a Buddhist.
So, that checks out.
His first book, The Astral Plane, was completed while he was staying with Bassant at the headquarters of the London Lodge with one of a long succession of young male acolytes, Kurupulumaj Jinarajadasa.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
It's pretty close. That's his friend, who is also a male friend, a young male friend of Leadbetter's.
Yes, I see.
One of his many young male friends. But just the one at the time.
Just the one.
Leadbetter was a natural psychic and encouraged Bassant's psychic abilities, and together they wrote a series of books on the history of Atlantis and Lemuria and the occult secrets of the atom. When Leadbetter was ejected from the society in 1906 for instructing young men to masturbate... See our episode on Leadbetter.
Yeah.
We've gone into this.
Yep.
It was Bassant who reinstated him. I say this in that episode, but it's important to note now that we're on Bassant's story. She's the one who reinstated him on becoming president in 1907.
Mm.
2 years later, Leadbetter would introduce Bassant to Krishnamurti, his choice for the vessel or world teacher. There's much more to say, of course, about the relationship between Bassant and Leadbetter. I just want to lay out the basics there, and they're going to have a very interesting back and forth over Krishnamurti as we move into the Krishnamurti story. So, Bree, this brings our story to the point where I'll need to change focus from Bassant to Krishnamurti. But for our purposes, we can be done today.
Okay.
except for this, right? I'm teasing you.
Okay.
I got one more thing I gotta do.
Okay.
I would like to address exactly what Bassant's own views of Theosophy were, because once we get into Krishnamurti, this becomes a new thing. So what did Bassant accept of Theosophy? In 1908, a year into her presidency, and the same year she updated and published the autobiography I read of hers, she made a tour of Australia, from which was published her Australian Lectures. In these lectures, Besant demonstrated remarkable consistency with Blavatsky and Theosophy nearly two decades after the publication of The Secret Doctrine. She took a softer tone than Blavatsky, who could be quite harsh in her attacks on rival groups, particularly in Isis Unveiled, but the targets were made the same: Orthodox Christianity, spiritualism, and atheistic materialism. In her talk on Theosophy and Christianity, she boasted that Theosophy holds membership in a range of faiths, including Christians, Hebrews, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Jains, and Sikhs, and Theosophists endeavor to spread peace among the creeds. She said, "We do not empty the churches. On the contrary, we bring back to them many of the intelligent and intellectual who have slipped away from them because of the narrow and crude presentment of many a Christian doctrine." This is my third ways argument. I mean, you and I have been talking about this brief for years on the show and off the show, that people aren't leaving the Christian church, but they're not leaving God or gods. Spirituality lingers, and I won't even say it lingers. I think it thrives in third way spaces, which are often looked down on, but are vibrant and important.
Yeah.
And that's what Besant's saying here. Don't worry about it. Yes, they're leaving the church because the church isn't serving them. Mm-hmm. It's happening right now. A lot of women, I just read recently, a lot of women are leaving the church.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. In America, anyway. Mm-hmm. The goal is to seek a core or original religion by penetrating through accumulated problems of the current religion and seeking its commonalities with other practices. The perennial philosophy. There is, said Besant, a mystery religion within Christianity, passed orally from teacher to student over time, up through at least the time of Origen. She said the Gnostic was the man who knew, not the man who believed. The mass of the Christian congregation were believers. The teachers and leaders were the Gnostics, the knowers. Very Blavatsky of her. The Gnostics have this inside track. And the atonement reflected deep alchemical truth. I mean, the atonement of Christ. Truly, she said, is it a wonderful atonement, a making one of higher and lower, and it makes oneness by lifting the manhood into divinity, making pure all who realize the oneness. But to us, the atonement is not necessarily possible only to one Christ. She defended and defined the principle of reincarnation and the concept of spiritual development over lifetimes. This is all pretty standard theosophical stuff. I'll quote her here. That every man is a living spirit. He is part of the life of the Supreme. He is the offspring of deity. As sparks come forth from a fire, so comes he forth from the divine spirit. He comes to earth to learn. All are equally ignorant when plunged into human life. Ignorance is the only original sin, and it is not criminal but inevitable. As the powers of the deity within him are unfolded, he grows into the stature of the perfect man.
Right? I feel like that deserves metal sounds.
Yes.
Specifically, the ignorance is the original sin part. Yeah.
It persists. In her lecture on life after death, she started with a theological problem that had bothered her from childhood, the doctrine of eternal damnation. She said, "The idea that the endless ages of everlasting life were determined once for all by the passing and often trivial events of the brief life between cradle and grave, I think, has had much to do towards making the vision of the other life unreal in our minds." She then outlined two ways of learning about the after-death life. The first, the spiritualist way. She said, there are two ways of learning about the after-death life, the spiritualist and the theosophist. But while the spiritualists have succeeded in proving the continuation of the soul after death, they have fallen short by missing the opportunity for spirits to leave living bodies and investigate the other side. So you can be a spirit too. Just because you're alive doesn't mean you got to stay home. Mm-hmm. Go out. Have a night out.
Have a night out.
Of your body.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't entirely true about spiritualism anyway, but her point following Blavatsky was that occultists should be active and not passive agents in their dealings with otherworldly beings. The more explicitly theosophical point was that there exist guardians of humanity. She said, the elder brothers of the race, who are men as we are men, but products of a longer evolution, who show in the perfection of their humanity the promise of what all of us shall ultimately become, are the ones we should look to. The guardians are the founders of the great religions of the world, the great revealers to humanity, and are still dwelling with humans. Besant's most pointed reference to the masters in her lectures. She doesn't dwell on the masters very much. There's so much a part of theosophical culture, but for Besant, she sort of leaves them in the background. She almost acknowledges that they're not the point.
Right.
The point is a rational point. It's a logical point, not a point about magical beings in a Tibetan lodge somewhere. The Master is preaching an inspired religion that merges all faiths into a single esoteric truth meant to elevate all of humanity up a chain of being toward the Godhead, where the basis of the belief system through which Besant and Ledbetter sought to establish Krishnamurti as the vessel, a prophet of a great new age of humanity enlightened by a bodhisattva of profound compassion and understanding, who had direct contact with the Masters. We'll see how that works out for them.
Yeah.
in the coming episodes. But Brie, final thoughts on Annie Besant.
I feel like I don't say this very often when we talk about people, but I have a level of respect for her as a human being, not just in what she did and her work and all of that and what she would lead up to with her beliefs and that part of her life, but just as a human being, I hold a lot of respect for how, even in her beliefs, and I think that's part of the point she was saying, is that it's not about the things that you are doing. It's not about these rules that are being shoved down your throat. It's not pushing people down because of a belief isn't what it's supposed to be doing. And so she's always seemed to have advocated outside of belief.
Uplifting people.
Yes. It's never about bringing anything down. It's always about progressing for her. It's not about damnation. It's not about all of that crap. It's about continuing things. There's not an end. It is a continuation and a progression, a development. There's a word I'm thinking of that I'm not reaching right
evolution?
Now. Yes, an evolution. For the betterment of everybody, not just a singular group of people.
It's optimistic, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, her words are one thing, her actions are another. And for the most part, I mean, Besant's not perfect. When we get into the theosophical politics, like that, there's some messy business thing with Ledbetter. There's messy business with Judge and Olcott. But at her core, she's an advocate for the downtrodden.
Yeah.
And that's so very consistent throughout her life. And she's a powerful speaker, and she uses that power to try to get people to do right.
Yeah, and I think you said optimism. That is not something we see with the people we talk about. She's so optimistic and hopeful, no matter what part of her life she's been in. It's always a through line, just like how she... Once she has something and she's set on something, she's going to have that belief and not go back on it for a technicality.
Yeah. She puts, I mean, atheism accepted.
Sorry. But
even then, I mean, we think about theosophy, I think, as the merging of, she was this very hardcore Christian and then she was this very hardcore atheist. And then theosophy is a kind of merging of those. I think that's why people view her as inconsistent, is because the Christianity and the atheism and then the theosophy, they don't all seem to talk to each other. But
yeah, but she feels so consistent to me, though, is the thing. Like,
she's trying to figure it all out and put all the pieces together. Just like we do,
she
I think, in 2024.
She's the most human person we've spoken about. And that's why I think I have that respect for her.
Yeah,
that, she feels
that
very
may be
real.
So. Yeah, that may be so. Yeah, not like a glowing personal life either with Annie Besant. I mean, just not a very happy romantic life, should say. Which is common among the great theosophists, perhaps Ledbetter accepted, and even then his romantic life was quite odd. But like Blavatsky, Olcott, I mean, these people were fairly not aromantic or anti-romantic, and Besant sort of falls into that, Kingsford even to a large extent. But her personal life, her devotion to her children, her devotion to causes, Krishnamurti even, as we'll find out. It's just fascinating, deep relationships she has with people.
Yeah, it feels like it's not something we see often when we talk about people on this show.
No.
And in the research I've done for you, too, it's the same thing.
Do you think they, like, retreat, right? They go off into their own. She's very much a woman of the world.
Yes.
Not a woman of the bookshelf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta get out in the world. All right, let me talk about our sources real quick. I don't do that often enough, and I feel like I've got to remedy that. Edmund Garrett's Isis Very Much Unveiled, being the story of the great Mahatma hoax. Annie Besant's autobiography, Annie Besant's Australian Lectures, Charles Knowlton's The Fruits of Philosophy, A Treatise on the Population Question, edited by Annie Besant and Charles Bradlaugh, and Peter Washington's Madame Blavatsky's Baboon. Primary sources for this, well, the last was a secondary source, but a lot of primary sources for my research on Annie Besant. I hereby adjourn and declare closed this meeting of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors until such a time as we get together and do it again. Bri Littoral, our metallurgic prophet, was my conversant today.
Yeah, bye, guys. Just be a kind human.
Yeah, and speak up for what you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Put yourself out there, and any way you can, and kindly.
Kindly, without kindly, the harming of others,
yeah.
Ideally.
Right, yes. Don't shout anybody down. Don't hit them on their way out of the lecture hall.
Maybe listen. Maybe have a conversation.
There you go. Bessant has got a lesson for us there. When we come back, it is time to explore Jiddu Krishnamurti, and I will say this on the next episode, but one of my favorite people I've read and learned from in this entire exercise of doing this podcast. So it's going to be a real treat, and I look forward to sharing the work and the life of Jiddu Krishnamurti with you here on Occult Confessions.